we sometimes look at crypto and we say, well, it is very different from any other asset class. And that's to some degree true, but I think there are similarities with other asset classes. If you look at something like gold, there are some similarities in the sense that, you know, you have a lot of different marketplaces all over the world, and, you know, some of them are more transparent than others. And so I think we have to be careful not to place concerns that out there that we haven't really placed on other asset classes.
Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there, how are you all? Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast anniversary episode. Yes, it's 1 year ago today I released the very first episode of the podcast. It has been quite a journey for me, and I have a very special interview to commemorate this with, as I got to visit the SEC in Washington, D.C. and interview Commissioner Hester Peirce. But before that, I do have a message from my show sponsors. So first up, I want to talk about Deribit again. They are the trading platform that a number of my trading buddies have been moving to. So why are they creating such a buzz? Well, firstly, they've never been hacked. Their platform is built for stability, so no system overload crashes like you get to see with other trading platforms when the prices go crazy, and they can easily support high-frequency trading. They also support instant withdrawals, and they have never once had a socialized loss, which is pretty cool, right? So if you want to check them out, head over to deribits.com, where you can get a 10% discount for your first 6 months. That's Deribits with an S, deribits.com. And please note, Deribit is not available for US customers. And let's also talk about my regular sponsor, BlockFi, who I'm hugely grateful to for supporting the show for so long. I got to visit them in New York this week, so I'll be telling you a bit more about what I learned about them from that pretty soon. Did you know you can take out a loan backed by your cryptocurrency? Whether you're looking to finance a business or even buy a house, BlockFi helps investors use their Bitcoin, Ether, and Litecoin without selling it. Backed by Mike Novogratz, BlockFi is the leading crypto to USD lender in the US, servicing over 45 states with interest rates as low as 7.9%. And they also have a special offer for the listeners of my podcast. If you sign up at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans under $10,000, or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans over $10,000. And applying takes less than 2 minutes. Okay, so on to my interview with Commissioner Peirce. And I've got to be really honest about this. I was a nervous wreck going into this. About a year ago, I was unemployed. I was trying to be a trader, not great at it. And I knew it wasn't something that was going to work for me long time. I used to have an advertising agency in London that went bust. And I kind of found myself out of a career, not knowing what to do with my life. Came up with the idea of doing a podcast. My buddy Rich Roll has one. And I decided to do it. Reached out to Luke Martin, said, did you want to come on it? He said yes. And a year later, I find myself at the SEC interviewing a commissioner, which is quite a strange journey to go on. It was quite a step up for me too, but Hester was really, really lovely. She was really friendly and made me feel totally at ease with the interview, so I'm really grateful to her for that. If you're not aware of Hester, she dissented when the SEC rejected the decision to disapprove a proposed rule change to list and trade shares of the Winklevoss Bitcoin Trust on the BATS BZX exchange. I put a link to that statement in the show notes. It's definitely worth a read. It's really interesting to read what Hester said about this. And in the interview, we discuss the role of the SEC, how decisions are made, and why Hester dissented. I hope you enjoy it. If you have any questions about it, you know you can reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And as I said, 1 year since I released the very first episode of the podcast, it's been quite a journey, which has taken me around the world. I've met so many interesting people, but I do have a few thanks I just want to put out there. So again, I just want to thank my buddy Rich Roll for inspiring me to do this. I met the guy in Italy a few years ago. He has the most amazing podcast. When I told him I had the idea, he said, yeah, go for it. He helped me find the equipment. He taught me how to prepare for interviews. He taught me how to release shows. So yes, a big thank you to Rich. I also want to say a big thank you to my buddy Justin, who I stay with out in LA. He kind of gave me the idea to start creating content, so thank you to him. I've got to say thank you to Luke Martin for agreeing to be the first guest on the show. I didn't have a product. I just reached out to him, told him what I was doing, and he agreed to come on it. But also every guest who's come on the show, because I am aware people are taking time out of their busy schedules to help me with this. A big thanks goes out to Jameson Lopp, not only for the 3 interviews we have done, but also for all the support and help he's given me in the background. And also, he took me to shoot my first gun, which is quite an interesting story. I want to say thank you to Laura Shin, who's also given me a bunch of support and guidance at various times in the background. The guys at Let's Talk Bitcoin, who welcomed me onto their network. And look, anyone who supported the show in any way at all, whether you're a listener, whether you share it, whether you've reviewed it on iTunes, if you've written to me, if you've become a patron, if you sponsor the show, whatever, I really, really can't thank you enough. I couldn't do this without help of all of you. And listen, if I've missed out anyone who's helped me specifically, I'm sorry. It's hard to try and remember because so many people have helped me out with so many ways with this. Listen, my portfolio is wrecked like a lot of you, but the podcast is now generating income, which for me as a single dad is utterly amazing because not only does it mean I can afford to keep doing this, but it also gives me the flexibility to do all the dad stuff, breakfast, homework, school runs and stuff like that. Quite a lot to juggle. So thank you to everyone. Honestly, from the bottom of my heart, I can't thank you all enough. I really can't wait to get on with this and do another year of interviews and hopefully continue to bring great guests on the show. Okay, so listen, I'll let you get on with the interview. I hope you enjoy it. As ever, if you've got any questions, you can always reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com and I look forward to hearing from you. Hi there, Hester. Thank you for having me over here at the SEC.
It's so nice to be here today. Thank you for making the trip over to come talk to me. And just want to start by giving my disclaimer, which is that the views that I represent are my own and don't necessarily represent the views of the commission or my fellow commissioners.
Okay, fantastic. So I have a nickname for you.
You do?
Yeah. So when I was preparing for my interview, I had a nickname and I've got you down as the Great Dissenter.
I'll take it. I mean, I like Crypto Mom, but...
Crypto Mom.
But the Great Dissenter works.
Yeah, so... I'd never heard of the term dissenting before I saw your response to the ETF rejection. So can you explain what dissenting is as a process?
Well, dissenting actually has a pretty long tradition at the SEC. So just for some background, the Securities and Exchange Commission is made up of five commissioners, one of whom is the chairman. And so and it's tends to be a balanced commission, so it's politically balanced. And so you get a lot of different viewpoints, and that means that sometimes you get people who don't agree with the decision of the commission. And in those cases, you can vote no, and at times people will do a public dissent. And that's what I did in the case of the ETF application.
So I'm going to quote you from that because I've read the whole thing, and I've got a lot of quotes from it actually. But I reject the role of gatekeeper of innovation, a role very different from and indeed inconsistent with our mission of protecting investors, fostering capital formation, and facilitating fair, orderly, and efficient markets. Accordingly, I dissent. It's a very powerful statement.
Well, I think it, you know, what I'm concerned about is that we have a really dynamic economy and we've got lots of people with really interesting ideas. And I think as a regulator, we have an important role to play. But our role is not to stand in the way of innovation. And so I want to be careful to stick to our statutory mandate, which is to uphold the statutory framework and make sure, you know, we have a specific mandate, and I want to make sure we stick to that mandate and then allow innovation within that mandate as much as possible. And I'm concerned that in a number of areas, we sort of stray away from that and we try to become a little bit more interventionist in what we allow and don't allow. And I think that's not really where we belong.
Okay. So I think the way we should talk about this, let's first talk about the SEC and allow people to understand what they do and what your role is and how the SEC works. And then maybe we'll start looking at a couple of the key issues that have come up recently. So if you could firstly just explain to me who the SEC is, why they are relevant, and what your role is within the SEC.
Sure. So the Securities and Exchange Commission is the regulator of the capital markets in the United States. We also have a sister regulator, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which regulates part of the capital markets, the futures markets, but we regulate the securities markets. And in that role, we're involved in investor protection. We try to maintain fair, orderly, and efficient markets and then promote capital formation. That's our threefold mission. And so we operate under a number of different statutes and we regulate everything from broker dealers to stock exchanges to offerings of securities. And my role, because it's set up as a commission, so as I mentioned, there are five of us, and we're actually the ones that vote on decisions. So whether that be a new rule coming out or an enforcement action, it'll be the five of us that vote. Now, there's a lot of work going on done by others on the staff, not us. And so the work that they do rolls up into the recommendations they make to us, and then we ultimately vote one way or the other. One area that there has been confusion, and I think it's worth highlighting here because it's been relevant in this area, is that there's so much within our mandate that we've delegated some things to the staff. So there's some decisions that the staff makes that we don't directly make. And that means that sometimes we, the commission, will say, okay, the staff has made this decision, but we want to think about it again. And so it's important to know that sometimes you'll see something coming out from the staff that then the commission says, hey, we want to take a second look at it. And then another important thing to know in this area is that the staff can actually provide guidance about things. And so there's a lot going on at the staff level that will be informal, a little bit more informal interactions with people out with regulated entities, for example. And they'll be providing guidance about maybe how to comply with a rule. And that's not official commission level guidance, so it's not an official position, but it can be very useful to people who are trying to figure out how to comply with the rules.
Okay, so staff can make a decision and sometimes the commissioners may reject it or choose to make a vote on it.
Right.
How does that actually decision come about?
Well, so there are specific rules that govern that. And, you know, it can come about in the sense that someone who's affected by the decision asks the commission to review it, or it can be that one of the commissioners might say, hey, I'd like to review this. So there are different ways that can come about, but that can sometimes lead to a little bit of confusion on the outside about what might be going on.
And if you haven't got a firm agreement, you have a vote?
Yeah, right. I mean, so typically then if a staff level decision gets pulled up for the commission, then the commission will have a vote on it.
And is it four commissioners, did you say?
Five. It's five, but one of them is the chairman, so he's in a different role. The chairman actually sets the agenda for the commission.
Right.
So he has a very important role. Our chairman is Jay Clayton, and
yes,
he plays the role of setting the agenda, and he manages the staff. So he, you know, is a commissioner, but obviously plays a very important role.
And am I right in seeing on one of the ETF decisions the vote was 3-1?
Well, so the one that I dissented on,
yes,
I was the lone dissenter.
So if that had been a 2-2, would Jay then have had the deciding vote?
Oh no, so there are times, so typically we're at 5.
Right, okay.
There are times when there's a slot open and then we're at 4.
Okay. So okay. And what was your personal journey coming to the SEC? How did you end up here?
Well, so I ended up going to law school a little bit on a whim, not really with a big plan in mind of what I wanted to do. But when I came out of law school, I had majored in economics as an undergrad, and I liked the idea of merging the two, law and economics. And I thought, oh, securities is a good area to end up in. And I ended up going to a firm that did a lot of securities work, so that helped as well. So I was there for a bit, and then I heard about, there were a lot of people actually at that firm had worked here at the SEC, so I heard about an opening at the SEC, and I came over here for 8 years. And then I left, I worked on Capitol Hill for a little bit, worked in the Senate, and then I went and worked at a university here in the DC area, and then had the opportunity to come back here.
And you were sworn in by the president, right?
No, the president doesn't literally swear you in.
Right.
But
I assumed but he was.
So the president nominates commissioners,
yes,
and then we go through Senate confirmation, and then you get sworn in. But it's not actually the president who does the swearing.
Right, okay. What's the
He's got other things to do.
Yes, I've seen he signed your
yes
thing there.
My commission.
Your
yeah,
commission there.
Yeah.
And is that quite a daunting process to go through?
It's a long process. In my case, it was particularly long because I went through it twice before I got
right
confirmed.
So you really deserve it now.
Well, I don't know if I deserve it, but it was a long process.
And before we get on to the other topics, your backgrounding, being aware of and understanding both cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin, where does that come from? And also, we should probably get the position clear. It's not necessarily that you are pro-Bitcoin, but you're pro-innovation, right?
I'm pro-innovation, and I want, you know, I think there's a lot of promise in cryptocurrencies and this new technology. And so I'm excited to see what happens with it. But of course, I'm not going to take a position on which aspect will be successful or not. So, my introduction to Bitcoin came when I was at the university because some of my colleagues worked on that area and knew quite a bit about it. So it was fun to learn from them about what they thought the potential was in that area. But I think, you know, in terms of learning about the topic, it's a big learning curve. And so I'm constantly trying to listen to podcasts that discuss the issue and talk to people who are knowledgeable about it. But obviously there's a lot with, as I mentioned, there's a lot within my mandate. So I'm trying to follow many issues, but always happy to talk to people. So I put a plug in for that. Anyone who wants to come by and talk to me would love to learn more from people who are actually engaged in.
And are you a hodler? Do you have any Bitcoin?
No, I don't. And the reason that I don't is I think that I don't want any questions about my objectivity. And so I just put it out there that I don't have Bitcoin or other crypto. And I think it's better that way. We have to be pretty careful about what we invest in any respect.
But it might come a day where you will have to, because it'll become a primary global asset.
That's possible.
That's possible. And just one last question before we start looking at the issues. I think people in the world of Bitcoin and crypto think this is all the SEC does and everything is about crypto. Yeah. But I'm sure you've got a number of other things on your plate that you're always looking at.
Yeah, so this sort of came home to me recently. We did a rule on mining, not crypto mining, but actually mineral mining.
Right.
And so I wanted to send out a tweet about it. Which, you know, because this is a pretty important rulemaking for what it is. But I wanted to, you know, make sure that people didn't think it was about crypto. So I put non-Bitcoin in the tweet, and that confused people even more because then they thought it was about other coins, not Bitcoin, but other crypto. And so then when they actually looked at it, they said, wait, this looks like it's about mining. And, you know, that's I think an example of the fact that we do lots of different things, and so this just some of this area falls within our purview. I think it's important to remember that the U.S. is a complicated regulatory framework, so even for people within the U.S., but I think especially for people looking in from the outside, so we have a lot of financial regulators, and we not only have financial regulators at the federal level, but we have state regulators that are active in this space. And so it can be a really daunting thing, not only to sort of understand what the framework is, but then to figure out who you need to interact with to do what you're trying to do. And so I'm certainly sympathetic to people who are a bit overwhelmed by it.
Yeah, so as I mentioned this morning, I was with Peter Van Valkenburg over at Coin Center, and he was explaining to me the number of regulators there are, but also with, for example, money transmission licenses.
Right.
You need to have 53 of them because 52 because essentially you need one in every state apart from, he told me one that didn't, Missouri or somewhere. But he said that's a real problem for people, especially with something like Bitcoin, which you can send anywhere at any time. And his hope was that at some point that money transmission licenses would become federally regulated.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who have suggested that, in the states. The states have a role to play in the system that we have set up now.
Okay, so let's talk about what people are going to want to hear about, which is ETFs. And obviously, as I said to you before, you came first on my radar with reference to the Winklevoss ETF, which was rejected. And I've read through your statement, and there were three key areas. So we'll unpack those. So the first point you said is that you felt that the proposed rule change satisfied the requirements of the Exchange Act Section 6B. Should we talk about that?
Sure.
So why do you think it was rejected by the other commissioners then? And why do you think they felt it?
Well, I mean, I don't want to speak for what my colleague, as I said when I started, I speak for myself. Now, I think that you can look at their decision and you can see sort of some of the themes running through their decision. And what I took issue with is that I think the decision looked a little bit below what the filing was. So what that filing was is an exchange had come in with an exchange-traded product that they wanted to list and have trade on their exchange. And so I think it's really important to make sure that it meets all the requirements for a product trading on that exchange. But when you start to look underneath and you say, well, we're uncertain about the Bitcoin markets, the underlying Bitcoin markets, because they're not as regulated as we're comfortable with, and there are no arrangements with these markets to make sure that we can monitor what's going on. Then I start to say, well, is that really, I mean, clearly the exchange has thought about the unique features of the underlying market, and they've tried to figure out how their product will work, taking those into account. And there were protections that were built in, thinking about the market. And so my concern is that we focus on the market at issue here, which is the exchange and the exchange-traded product, and not stray beyond that. And I think there also, you know, are concerns that we sometimes look at crypto and we say, well, it is very different from any other asset class. And that's to some degree true, but I think there are similarities with other asset classes. If you look at something like gold, there are some similarities in the sense that, you know, you have a lot of different marketplaces all over the world, and, you know, some of them are more transparent than others. And so I think we have to be careful not to place concerns that out there that we haven't really placed on other asset classes. Now, to be fair, there's some of these same issues were looked at in connection with gold and other types of things, but I would argue maybe we went too far there too. So that's kind of, you know, I think we need to hew pretty closely to our statutory mandate. And I just interpreted it differently than my colleagues did.
Yeah. And I found the second point even more interesting, where you said the disapproval order inhibits institutionalization, essentially, of the asset class. And I put myself in brackets. Thus, it kind of inhibits investor protection. So what I put down is kind of like this chicken and egg, because with institutionalization of the product, we have more liquidity, we have more innovation, we will have better investment in custodian solutions, and we will have a more stable market. And the market operators will be incentivized to operate a more transparent and kind of open market. But it's not going to achieve that without institutionalization. So it's kind of like this chicken and egg situation.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I do feel that it's the same way. And I think it's interesting in this area because there's some people who really don't want institutionalization in this market, in the underlying market. And I understand that too. I mean, you know, there's a community that says we really don't want this to be intertwined with the sort of more traditional financial system. But there are a lot of people who are saying, you know, we think this is something that a lot of investors want to have exposure to, and a lot of people want to have in their portfolios. And if we do bring in institutions, it's, you know, to your point, it's going to change the markets. It's going to add some discipline to the markets because institutions understand markets very well, and they'll be able to kind of push back and say, here are some changes that we think are important. And so I think that that can be a very valuable, as you put it, investor protection. And it can be a way ultimately for retail investors, you know, maybe not right away, but ultimately for retail investors to engage with the market with the help of some institutions.
And I think you also pointed out that it isn't really the SEC's role to decide whether Bitcoin will be a successful product or not. That is down to the market. And I think you said they will do a better job than the SEC anyway.
Right.
So you just want the market to play out itself.
Yeah, I mean, this is my broader philosophy, is that it's never good for the regulator to say, this product is good, this product is bad, we think investors should be here and not here. Because ultimately, one of the beautiful things about the market is that it brings together lots of different perspectives from people with all kinds of different information. And so whereas we as a regulator come to it with one perspective and with limited information. And so I think really we want to incorporate as many voices into the marketplace as possible. I mean, I think this is one of the neat things about crypto, which is that you are bringing together people from all over the world, and they're able to express their views about this one will be successful, this one won't be, and they're able to, and a lot of these things, you know, they can weigh in, the community can weigh in as to which direction something is going to go. And I think that's really an interesting development because it does pull in information from all over the place. And so that's what I want to see happen. And I don't want to see decisions about success or failure centralized at a regulator.
And then the last point you made was the disapproval order dampens innovation. And is there a fear there that certain entrepreneurs or certain investors will start looking to foreign markets where maybe there isn't such a tight regulatory lens? I mean, Malta has been very successful in attracting companies there. Is that a fear of yours?
Well, I do worry that we send a message that says to people, you know, we are very cautious about innovation. And this is something that is certainly not unique to the crypto space, but regulators have a tendency to want to go slow on innovation, because if something does go wrong, we will get blamed. People will come to us and they'll say, you had an opportunity to step in and stop this and you didn't. And it may be that investors will get hurt and people will come and say, or will lose money and people will come and say, you could have stopped people from that. So I think we need to just remember that there's an important role for regulators to play, but there's also this very important role for innovation to play in improving all of our lives. And so can we get that balance right so that we tell people we're really excited about the fact that you want to innovate and we want to work with you to make sure that our regulatory framework works in a way that you can innovate. You know, we're not interested in fraudsters. We're not interested in people who are just trying to rip people off, but people who have really interesting new ideas and want to try them out on the market, we want them to come here. And so I do, you know, this country is built on drawing brilliant ideas from all over the world. Because we have such deep capital markets, people want to come here because they can find the money to support those ideas. And I certainly want the U.S. to continue to be a center of innovation and a center of creative thinking. I do worry that if we send the message that it's just too hard to get through the regulatory thicket here, people will go to places where they say, okay, well, we're going to be much more open to innovation.
It does actually feel to me, though, that the SEC have been pretty fair up until now in almost everything they've done. I was with Jesse Powell from Kraken recently, mm-hmm. and he commented the same. It felt almost like the SEC itself has taken a very kind of soft approach, almost to let the market play out and see which items you need to focus your attention on. Is that on purpose?
Well, so I think we certainly have people here. So Chairman Clayton has been very good about bringing people in who have knowledge in this area. So we have Bill Hinman, who's from Silicon Valley, comes with a real understanding of, you know, obviously the role that tech plays in our economy and the role that innovation plays. And then we have someone who is responsible. She sort of oversees our crypto initiatives across the commission, Val Stepanek. And she also has been, I think, widely respected because she brings a deep knowledge and interest in this area and has taken, you know, has, I think, led the agency in taking a cautious, careful approach. And so that's great. And I think it's really important that we've gone after some of these people who have, you know, just said that they're crypto and then they steal people's money, right? So that's clearly something that we're going to go after and try to stop. And we have been more deliberate in taking actions against folks who are not engaged in fraud, but are not complying with our rules, right? So we also have to tell people, look, just because you're calling something crypto doesn't mean that you can ignore the rules that we've had in place for many years. So we are trying to get that balance right. And I think we've done a lot of things right in this area. But I do think that we also need to be a little bit more willing to open the doors a little bit wider to innovation. So that's kind of what I'm pushing for.
Next up, I talk to Hester Peirce more about her work at the SEC. But before that, I have a message from my show sponsors. So let's talk about Deribit again, the platform for Bitcoin traders. As I mentioned before, I am very excited to be working with these guys. Lots of my trader buddies have been moving over to their platform, been hearing a lot about it. So why? Well, they've never been hacked. The platform is built for stability, so they have no system overloads and can easily support high-frequency trading. They have instant downloads and have never once had a socialized loss. Right now, they are the only Bitcoin futures platform offering up to 100x leverage for you crazy leverage traders. Perpetual contracts with up to 100x leverage too, and the only liquid Bitcoin options market in the world. Go and check them out. They've got a special offer. They've got a 10% discount for your first 6 months of trading on the platform. That's at deribits.com, which is deribits.com. But please note, Deribit is not available for US citizens. And next up, I also want to talk about my regular sponsor, BlockFi. So do you need to make a payment, but you don't want to sell your crypto? BlockFi can help. BlockFi is the leading crypto to USD lender in the US, servicing over 45 states. Use your crypto to do things like buy a car, pay off your credit cards, or even pay your taxes. There's no need to buy tokens or pay a membership fee to get started. Just visit blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid to learn more about using your crypto without selling. And as I mentioned, they do have a special offer for the listeners of my podcast. If you sign up at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans of under $10,000, or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans over $10,000. And applying takes less than 2 minutes.
Yeah, I was with Jake Chavinsky last night. I'm not sure if you know Jake. He's a lawyer. And he said to me, what people don't seem to understand is that securities laws have been here for a long time. Yeah. It doesn't matter if it's a crypto asset. If it's a security, it is a security.
And correct.
And people seem to have missed that. So I'm going to have some questions for you on that as well. But I just want to finish on the BZX. You would say Z, wouldn't you? BZX.
Yeah.
Yeah, we would say BZX. Yeah. What's the current status of that now, then? Because it's whilst it was rejected, it's still open, right?
So now, I mean, we're in a period where you can provide comments. We have a number of applications that are pending, and so they're at different stages. But you know, we've had a comment period open on some of these, so people, which I think has been useful because people have weighed in. It, you know, it can be anyone can weigh in and tell us.
Is
what
this
they
on the
think.
Website?
You can yeah, see. You can weigh in on the website.
Do you read all the comments?
I have read a lot of the comments, but I haven't read all of them. We get lots of comments and lots of things, but I will tell you that comments are extremely useful, especially if there's something a little bit deeper than approve a Bitcoin ETP, please. You know, it's really helpful if people actually try to engage and wrestle with some of the issues that we're wrestling with here. That can be very instructive to us. So I'm always eager to read letters from people who have put some thought into it.
There are some funny ones.
There are.
And so therefore, is it helpful for you to work? Is someone like CoinCenter very helpful for you then?
I mean, we have really benefited from a lot of people across the spectrum who have weighed in from a very thoughtful perspective and who have tried to think through some of the issues that are difficult and provide color. And so, you know, across the spectrum, we're getting lots of valuable input. The one thing that I will say just in general is, you know, from my Twitter feed, I get a lot of requests to give a comment on timing. When is there going to be an approval order? And it's just not something that I can weigh in on. Timing is, you know, is difficult to predict for one. And the second thing is that, you know, each one is judged on its merits. So each one is slightly different. Each one is organized differently, is designed differently. And so I think what people need to do is kind of let the regulatory process play out. They need to continue making the case, whatever they think, whether they're in favor or against, you know, continue making the case. Because obviously convincing one commissioner that this might be the way to go is not going to win the day. You've got to convince more of us than that, especially we have five. So that means you probably have to convince three of us that that a particular product should go forward.
And is it a case that you spend time discussing and trying to convince the other commissioners? Is that how it works? Do you debate it together?
Yeah. So the interesting thing about the way the commission runs is that we have this law called the Sunshine Act, which means that if we're going to discuss something, all of us together, we can only do it in public, unless it's enforcement. There are exceptions for things like enforcement, which you can have a private meeting. You're obviously not going to do that in public. But so we can have one-off conversations with each other, but it's never going to be the five of us sitting in a room debating whether a particular product should get approved or not. But certainly, you know, my colleagues know that I feel strongly about us trying to think about these from a positive direction, in the sense that we need to think about how they fit within our rule book, and we need to not just assume that because it's crypto or digital assets or whatever you want to call it, that it raises all these new issues. It does raise some new issues, but some pieces of it fit very neatly within what we already do.
Right, okay. So I'm trying to think carefully sometimes how to word these questions, because obviously you have to be certain way you can reply. But do you feel that an ETF will be inevitable, is inevitable?
Well, I don't think I could say anything is inevitable. I think that there's a lot of interest from investors, from institutional and retail, and from the exchange community, and from sponsors of these products. So I think there's a lot of intellectual capital being put into addressing some of the concerns. We have futures markets, for example. Those are relatively new. But again, we're getting experience. Things are getting more developed. So I can't say that anything is inevitable, but I can say that given the amount of time and energy being spent in this area, I think it's definitely possible that we could get that we could see products that are based on cryptocurrencies in our markets.
Right. Okay. And what are the remaining primary issues for an ETF to be approved?
Well, I think, people ask me that, and I think, again, I have to emphasize that it's a case-by-case consideration. And so because some of these really are designed quite differently from one another, so I think you have to take that into account. But you can get guidance by looking at the orders that we've put out. The Winklevoss order was one, and then the order that the staff put out does give a sense of where the concerns are. So I think people can kind of address those concerns.
So it feels like it's a ongoing relationship, therefore, with the commission. Here's our response. It's not, they can go away and they can work on and resubmit, right?
I like that way of describing it. It's kind of a conversation that we're having. And so, there are different iterations in that conversation. And so I think people have to kind of listen to what the other folks are, what in this case the commission is saying, and respond to those concerns. So I think that's a good way of describing it.
And respecting what you've said, it's still a case-by-case basis. I do, though, expect once one is approved, if one does get approved, does that create some kind of precedent around certain key areas of decision-making? Or does it?
Yeah, I think it does start to set markers of what you might expect to see in an application. But again, understanding that different people might approach it differently and might come up with different solutions. But yeah, it certainly starts to set a precedent. And I think then once people see how these products actually trade, that'll also help to inform the commission as it thinks about what it wants to do with future applicants.
Okay. I think we've done enough on ETFs there. So let's go back to the wider work that the SEC is doing. It feels to me, as I mentioned earlier, it's been in phases. So it felt like phase one was the outright scams. Phase two, it felt like with Paragon and Airfix that you are enforcing the regulations that already exist, and same with EtherDelta. I feel like maybe there's another phase coming now where it will be the precedents that you set with those will be used to bring action against all the rest of the ICOs. Is that a good picture of what's happening?
Well, again, I think we do really think about these things on an individual facts and circumstances basis, and we have to. No two of these things are identical, but I think that we had the Dow report, and that was, a signal. One thing that I really would like to emphasize is that I think we're bringing enforcement actions, but we also need to provide some guidance that doesn't come in the form of enforcement. And so I'm eager for us to maybe provide some guidance that comes in the form of guidance, not actually an enforcement action, because I don't think that's the best way for people to understand what our thinking is, just to see us bringing enforcement actions.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like you just want to harm the industry. It feels like you want to enforce the regulations that are there, but help support the industry to grow to something that can benefit wider communities and wider people who are interested in building with these products. But you can't ignore if regulations have been ignored.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that is the issue that we're facing, is that people have been raising money for through the sale of securities for many, many years, right? And we've put a particular framework in place. And so when people come up with a new way of doing it, we're going to think about how that interacts with the framework we already have in place.
Right. So when you bring in, when you start looking maybe at an ICO, what are the powers that you have when, say, if they've broken regulations, what are the powers you have?
Well, we have, we can place an injunction on someone, which basically says you have to comply with the law. We can impose penalties. We can force people to register. There's force is a strong word, but right, people can be asked to register their securities with us. Now, it's a lot of these enforcement actions, not only in this area but in many areas, are done through settlements, which are negotiated settlements. So if we go to someone and we say we're thinking of bringing an enforcement action against you, they can say, you know what, let's not fight this out in court, let's just come to an agreement and settle it. And so those are going to be tailored, again, to the facts and circumstances. But we have some typical types of remedies that we do engage in. And, you know, sometimes it's just to say, well, now that the information is out there, why don't you give investors the opportunity to say, you know what, we're not interested? Because at the time that they bought the securities, they should have had access to that information. Now give them the access to the information and see whether they still want to stay invested or not.
Right. Okay. So it feels like you really want to avoid litigation then.
Well, I think litigation, takes a lot of time and money on both sides. So a lot of our enforcement actions tend to be resolved through settlements. Now that's not always a good thing. Sometimes it is good to take the issues and hash them out in court, so that a court can weigh in and say, well, we look at the law differently than you, the SEC, looks at it, or than you, the person the SEC is suing, looks at it. So that can be helpful, but it's expensive and time-consuming.
For both sides.
Right.
Yeah. And in looking at the future of cryptocurrencies, do you think the market will benefit from greater clarity and therefore be able to develop further if they have full understanding of what the SEC considers the compliant way to run an ICO?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's always helpful for people to understand what the SEC, how the SEC interprets its own rules as they apply in the ICO context. And then, you know, then people can really think about, is this the best way for me to raise money? Maybe it is for some and it isn't for others. But I think we also need to think about some of the more difficult and issues that are maybe unique in this context. So you might have something that's an ICO where it starts out really as you trying to raise capital from people to whom you sell tokens. But eventually those tokens might be something very different than securities. And so how do we tell people when that line has been crossed? And then I think one of the issues that, you know, would be helpful if we provided more guidance about what we actually think is a security, just so that the platforms that are trading these things kind of have a sense of what's in and what's out, because whether or not they're trading securities then flows into whether or not they have to register with us as an exchange. So part of how these enforcement actions work is that the staff is constantly working on enforcement actions across the board about lots of different things, and then they'll prepare a recommendation for us. And it'll come up to us. And often that recommendation will come in the form of, we've investigated this entity X and they've agreed to settle. And here are the terms of the settlement. What do you commissioners think of the settlement?
Right. Okay. So you must have an awful lot of work on at the moment.
We do have lots of work about lots of different types of issues related to crypto and non-crypto alike. So we're busy, and you know, enforcement regulations. So we do have a lot on our plates.
So have you grown quite a big crypto team here then?
Well, the you know, I think the chairman is trying to build a team under Val Stepanek, as I mentioned. On my staff, I have someone who works on crypto issues, but she also works on many other issues. So, you know, I don't have one person who's dedicated just to those issues.
Does the SEC look at privacy tokens at all? Is that something that comes under your lens?
Well, again, I think we're going to look at any token from the perspective of, is it a security? And if it's not, then it falls outside our jurisdiction.
Falls into somebody else. Yeah. How much do you work with the other regulators?
So we do have a lot of interaction with the other regulators, again, on a range of issues, but cryptocurrency is one of those issues. And I think that's an area that is possible for some really fruitful work, just because, again, as we talked about, there's so many regulators, and trying to figure out, hey, where do I enter this regulatory framework, and who do I go to first? If we could have a little more coordination on, hey, just come in and talk to one of us and we'll kind of help you get to the right place, I think that could be helpful. So I think there are efforts underway to try to work both with domestic regulators, but also to, you know, talk to other regulators around the world and say, hey, how are you approaching these issues? So I think there have been some really positive discussions.
And having, you know, you're essentially part of the crypto community now in one way or another. You're out on Twitter and you've had quite a few people obviously follow you and interested in what you're saying. What's your kind of overall picture of the market? What do you make of it?
Well, again, I mean, to me, it's just really, it's really exciting to see people who are excited about the work they're doing. And you know, I love seeing the fact that people are challenging each other's work. And so there are some people who believe really strongly in one particular approach to doing things, and others come in and say, no, you know, we can do it faster and with consuming less energy, or, you know, we have a way to make things more efficient, or we have a way to better incorporate lots of different ideas from the community. And so to me, it's exciting to see people who have such deep knowledge and who are really applying it and thinking of ways that they can apply it to make certain functions in our society work better. So from that perspective, that's what I love most about the community, is just the positive potential for doing something for society. Now, again, some of it is going to succeed and some of it's going to fail, is my guess. So it's really fun to watch people who are engaged and believe in their ideas that they're pushing and are working hard at them.
Is it unique compared to the other markets that you regulate and look at?
Well, it's unique in the sense that it tends to be a different group of people. And I think that's great too, right? So we have a financial industry that is dynamic and innovative, but it's also a little bit more conservative, right? And so you have people coming in, conservative not in the political sense, but conservative in the sense that we've done things in a particular way for some time. And so you have people coming in from the outside and saying, hey, I have a new idea about how you might do X, Y, and Z. And so it's always great to get fresh ideas into the space. And I think that's true of the financial system. That's true of any other part of our economy. Yeah, it's a different group of people, and that's why I think it's exciting to see them bring in, you know, you always want people to come in and say, hey, I know you've been doing things this way for a long time, but can we think about doing it this way? And if we do it this way, would we be able to involve more people in the financial system? And would we be able to really improve people's lives? I love that possibility.
You can see that every time we get onto the point of something to do with tech innovation, you can see that something that kind of excites you.
Yeah.
I think, but like you say, that's a very American thing, right?
It's a bit of an American thing. Yeah, I think it is. But, you know, I think that's one of the things that we're all hoping for, is that we can make changes that will then help something to work better in our society, or help someone's life to be better in our society. And that's kind of That's kind of the core of why I came to this job, because capital formation is all about getting money to people who have ideas about how they can make the world a better place. And so that's the function of the SEC, to set the framework within which people can do that. And so when I see a new technology that says we're going to be able to kind of crash through some barriers that have been there and make it easier for a wider swath of people to be involved, I think that is exciting.
And I think the wider community really appreciates the work you've done. I know, speaking to people saying I've come in here, they were very excited, saying, oh my God, Hester, she's amazing. So I would say thank you to people on behalf of everyone.
Well, that's kind. But again, it's the real exciting work is happening among the entrepreneurs, the people who are really applying their knowledge and thinking of new ways to solve problems. So I think that's where the real excitement is.
I think it's happening everywhere. I think this conversation is part of it. I think it's an innovative technology. Hester, what do you do outside of regulations and crypto? Are you a football fan? Are you a...
I'm an American football fan as far as I defend my home team, the Cleveland Browns. But
did I read something about Condoleezza Rice perhaps becoming head coach?
No, that is not a question I was expecting to get asked. But I read something about that too, yeah. And then I cannot speculate. That's certainly outside of my purview, but I thought it was interesting to read.
I did, because the Cleveland Browns are struggling, right?
Cleveland Browns are doing great.
I thought they were. Didn't they have two head coaches go recently?
Again, I have to stick to the line that the Cleveland Browns are... No, they're actually having a great season this year. So
you're from Ohio?
I am from Ohio.
Are you a Buckeye?
I am.
You've got a big game coming up this weekend, haven't you, against Michigan?
Yeah, no, I'm from Cleveland, so I am a Buckeye. And you can take the girl out of Ohio, but you can't take the Ohio out of the girl.
So you're surprised I know this, aren't you?
I am. I'm impressed.
I was dating a girl from Ohio last year, and she made me become a Buckeye, and she got me into college football.
Perfect.
And I've been invited, because I'm going to New York after this, and all my friends in New York have said, no, we're not here. We're away for Thanksgiving. So I've been invited to Ohio for Thanksgiving.
There's no better place you could be.
Hester, this has been amazing. I've really, really enjoyed this, and thank you so much for allowing me to come here and do this.
No, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
No, it's fantastic. A year ago, I was unemployed, and a year later, I'm in the SEC interviewing a commissioner. Don't know how this has happened. Just some final thoughts. What can the wider people do in the Bitcoin and crypto community to better help themselves and better help the SEC and you do your work?
Well, again, I encourage people to come in and talk to us. It's sometimes a little daunting to come talk to a regulator, but if you're trying to do something that you really think will help improve society, it's usually good to try to figure out how you can do that within the regulatory framework. So I encourage people to come in. I love it when people come take the time to talk to me. I realize people are busy, and so, you know, talking to a regulator is not always a fun thing to do, but it is helpful just to educate me and, help me be able to better say and understand how maybe there's some pressure points that we can address at the SEC. If I don't know what's going on, it's really hard for me to figure out where those pressure points and difficulties might be.
Right. And lastly, how should people stay in touch? And I know you said people shouldn't follow you on Twitter because you said you're quite boring on Twitter. It's all regulatory stuff. And
well,
I
write about regulatory stuff, so I don't really anticipate that people would find my tweets very interesting. But, you know, always welcome people to communicate with me that way. Or if you're really trying to get in touch with me, it's best to email commissionerperce@sec.gov. And that's P-E-I-R-C-E.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so what did you make of the interview with Hester? Did you enjoy it? It was definitely a challenge for me. It was definitely a big step up. You know, Hester has certain questions she couldn't answer, or there are certain ways she has to answer questions due to the role she has working at the SEC. So it was a big step up for me to try and deal with that. But I loved having the opportunity, and I am really, really grateful for Hester for agreeing to do this and inviting me over to the SEC. And also just a big thanks to her for the work she's done in supporting innovation in crypto. It's very, very cool
The dissent she did is very cool. The work she's doing to try and help Wall Street and institutions adopt crypto is amazing. So I'm a big fan of hers. I suggest you check out the show notes, read about everything she's done. There's some really, really interesting stuff in there. I've also invited Hester out to the UK to see Metallica next summer. They're touring, they're playing Twickenham. I'm not sure if she'll make it, but if she decides to, then I will definitely take her to Twickenham to see them. Okay, so I'm 1 year in. The show survives with the help of everyone else. So look, I tell this every week, but there are a whole bunch of things you can do to help. So firstly, you can become a patron. You can head over to patreon.com/whatbitcoindid. I'm now at 37 patrons. The money that comes in from that helps keep the show going. So thank you to everyone who's done that so far. If you're interested in becoming a patron, head over there and feel free to let me know if you have any questions. You can become a show sponsor. If you're interested, then please email me on hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Downloads are growing rapidly. I'm going to crack through 100,000 this month, which is pretty amazing. You can leave me a review on iTunes or subscribe. Hopefully you think I deserve a 5-star. That really helps with the rankings. You can follow me on social media. I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram, I'm on Medium. I'm at whatbitcoindid on everything, and you know you can reach out to me. You can check out my website, which is www.whatbitcoindid.com, which I'm always filling with useful different ways. You can navigate the old episodes, you can navigate by guest, you can navigate by topic. I put up all the transcriptions for the interviews. You can also sign up to my newsletter. I have a daily Bitcoin newsletter, which somebody is helping me produce. If you want that, you can head over to the website and click on the subscribe button, and you can share the show out with your friends and family. Okay. One last time, massive thank you to everybody who supported the show for the last year. Honestly, I can't put into words how grateful I am. It is truly amazing all the support I've received from people, from guests, from listeners, from just from anyone. So thank you, thank you, thank you. If you've got any ideas, you've got any questions, feel free to reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com, and I look forward to another year of producing podcasts. Okay, have a great week, and I'll see you soon.